Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an appraisal of Donald Trump's extreme narcissism and examine the extent to which it is a personality disorder or a psychiatric condition with Richard Friedman, a professor of clinical psychiatry at the Weill Cornell Medical Center and an attending psychiatrist at New York Presbyterian Hospital, who is a contributing op-ed writer to the New York Times. He joins us to discuss the Republican presidential frontrunner's pathological narcissism and the misplaced hyperbole surrounding accusations against Trump that involved analogies with Hitler and Mussolini, which miss the point that Trump has a genius for empathy, as more and more Americans feel he understands their anger and sense of betrayal. Then we will get an analysis of how coded dog whistle political messages are morphing into the mainstream of Republican presidential discourse as Donald Trump takes the debate to new highs or lows, while Dr. Ben Carson continually rails against political correctness, which is the new code word for permission to express bigotry. Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, joins us to discuss the manipulation of white anxiety by Trump and Cruz, who Ian Haney-Lopez feels is far more dangerous and cynical than Trump. Then finally, with Florida looking more and more like a campaign-ending humiliation for Marco Rubio, we'll get an update on the other key March 15th primary state of Ohio that has a winner-take-all hall of delegates Trump, Cruz, and Kasich have their eyes on. Daniel Tokaji, a professor of law at the Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law, whose area of expertise is election law and civil rights, joins us. We will discuss whether Ohio Governor Kasich's last stand will amount to anything and whether Cruz's newfound momentum will lift him from third place in the polls in Ohio behind Trump and Kasich. And joining us now is Richard Friedman, MD, who is a professor of clinical psychiatry at the Weill Cornell Medical College, attending psychiatrist at New York Presbyterian Hospital, and director of psychopharmacology at the Payne Whitney Psychiatric Clinic. He's also a contributing op-ed writer to the New York Times. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Friedman.
Thank you.
And in terms of Donald Trump's psychiatric profile, if you will, I take it that this is dangerous waters that one would enter. Going back to Barry Goldwater in 1964, there were attempts to psychoanalyzing him from afar, which were considered unethical. And
right.
I take it one has to be pretty careful about what you say
right.
in that regard.
Right.
Right.
No, you've got your history exactly right. You know, mental health professionals are perfectly willing and able to talk about general principles of psychology as they pertain to candidates, but what they can never do is cross the line and give them diagnostic labels, because that would imply that they're actually, you know, have examined and treated them, and no candidate in their right mind would ever give consent for such a thing.
So on the surface, though, one could make the charge, as many have, or the observation that Donald Trump is an obnoxious, grandiose blowhard. But on the other hand, I take it that among politicians, it seems to be endemic, doesn't it, a certain amount of pathological narcissism.
You're right. I mean, there are character traits that are adaptive for politicians, and that if you don't have them, you're not going to be successful. Meaning, on the one hand, you have to be ambitious. It might even be useful to have a slight degree of paranoia, you know, to be scanning the world for, you know, all kinds of problems that might come your way. You might be wrong a lot of the time, but if you're not alert, you're likely to be gobbled up in the process. And narcissism, which generally refers to, you know, one's self-regard. And, you know, you can have a little of it or you can have a lot of it. And I think the public has been struck with, you know, Donald Trump's self-aggrandizing style. One thing that really hasn't been discussed is, you know, why people are so puzzled about the fact that this man, who so many people describe as obnoxious, divisive, etc., has resonated so deeply with American culture, most voters. Why is he so popular? What explains his popularity?
Well, go ahead and give us your ideas on that, madam.
I think one element that explains his popularity is he has an uncanny ability for empathizing. And now, this is going to sound counterintuitive to your listeners, because most people will be shocked to hear him described as empathetic, since the common idea of empathy is that means you understand people and are nice to them. It doesn't. It just simply means that you have a way of understanding how people think. You can imagine how they think and feel, and you can use that understanding for doing good or for doing bad. And what Trump has clearly understood is that there's a sizable fraction of American people, those who are unemployed, those who feel betrayed, those who feel that, you know, the American dream has eluded them and they're never going to get it, who are quite understandably angry. And he has completely accurately grasped the angry nature of a big fraction of the American electorate. And he said to them, in effect, I know exactly how angry you are. I know why you're angry. And we're just going to break up the country. We're going to stop this from happening. He's made people feel understood in terms of their, you know, betrayal and their anger. And that's extremely powerful.
But is there any sort of authenticity to this tactic, if it is a tactic, or if it is indeed real empathy?
Right.
Because his policy prescriptions are so thin, you can be reasonably skeptical that he's not either one, serious, or two, capable of delivering.
Right. Well, so you put your finger on the problem, which is if you empathize with people and they feel that you understand them, then the next step is, if you're really an effective, well-intending politician, you then have to take the next step, which is to say, I get why you're so angry, and actually I have some good, reasonable, interesting ideas to fix the predicament you're in, which is the cause of your anger. I mean, I'm not a politician, but as any reasonable observer, it would appear that Donald Trump does not have that. Meaning what he's got is the ability to rile people up and make them feel understood in terms of their anger. But what he doesn't have is a series of policies that would fix the predicament that they're so angry about. That's what's so astounding.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Friedman, MD, who's a professor of clinical psychiatry at the Weill Cornell Medical College, and he's also an attending psychiatrist at New York Presbyterian Hospital and director of psychopharmacology at the Payne Whitney Psychiatric Clinic, and a contributing op-ed writer to the New York Times. So what is the line then between a personality disorder and a treatable psychiatric condition?
Well, you know, it's a bit like blood pressure and hypertension. Everybody has a blood pressure, but not everyone has hypertension. We usually draw the line at the place where the trait in question, whether it's, you know, a personality disorder or any other condition, whether it causes symptoms and impairment. So, you know, people are said to have personality disorders when their character traits are in such a level that they actually start impairing their ability to function in the real world and cause trouble.
So functionality, then, is the key, is it?
Right. Now, you know, there are people with personality disorders who function at very high levels. It doesn't mean that, you can't function at all, but generally people with personality disorders cause a lot of trouble for people around them in the world.
Well, there have certainly been cases, I think, of billionaires with Asperger's. You could make the argument that Richard Nixon had paranoid tendencies, right?
Yes. And again, I mean, some of these traits that people find unlikable might actually be useful and adaptive in certain situations. And, you know, whether or not a politician has them, you know, at levels that cause a problem is in some ways, you know, defined by the people who are evaluating him, meaning the electorate.
Well, already, though, you've got Bill Maher, for example, cutting together Donald Trump speeches with Adolf Hitler speeches, and
right.
Comedian Louis C.K. Emailing his list saying that it was funny for a little while, but this guy is Hitler. You've also got Der Spiegel, the German magazine, calling Trump the most dangerous man in the world. So is that hyperbole?
It's hard to know because, you know, the things that he says for public consumption as a political candidate, you have a very hard time evaluating, you know, what his core beliefs are. And I say this because so many of the things that he said contrary things. Is he pro-life? Is he for abortion? I mean, there are so many positions that he's taken over the years that seem to contradict one another that it's hard to actually make a case. You know, that, you know, how as a political figure he would actually rule and whether he represents a danger. He's changed his positions on so many things, it's very hard to actually pin him down and know what he's really like. Who is the real Donald Trump? What are those values that don't change from moment to moment and are not susceptible to political winds? I don't think anyone really knows. But except for one thing, which is he clearly enjoys getting a lot of attention. That's, I would say, an enduring value. But other than that, it's very hard to know who is the real Donald Trump.
But what is, I think, real and even perhaps some kind of political tradition in this country, and also in fundamentalist or evangelical religion, now that you've got the so-called prosperity gospel out there that sort of replaced the Bible, there is aspirational politics. And my sense is that the billionaire is essentially promising everybody that they're going to win the lottery.
Well, it's a very powerful message. And it resonates even if the policies don't back it up. And I think this is one of the reasons that the Republican Party is so anxious. I mean, in some ways, you could say that Trump has not really threatened to fracture or destroy the Republican Party so much as unveil it. He's enunciated many things that the Republican Party has hinted at over many years, but he says it rather in a vulgar, direct way. So, you know, why is it that so many, you know, members of the Republican rank and file were so angry and upset about the standard bearers of the Republican Party coming out last week against Trump and basically begging them to do everything they could to stop him? Because it read to the American people that their, you know, the Republican elite thought that they were too dull, dim-witted to make up their minds for themselves.
Well, I suppose when Mitt Romney said he's a fraud and a phony and his promises are as worthless as a degree from Trump University, that is a backhanded way of saying you're gullible and you're being duped. But on the other hand, how else does the establishment warn its electorate?
That's correct. But the problem is that the people who are doing the warning are not don't seem to be so ideologically different than the danger they're warning against. After all, it was Romney who, you know, wasn't as blunt about building a wall between the United States and Mexico, but I think made some statement to the effect that so many millions of American undocumented workers should self-deport. It's a little like the kettle calling the pot black. Who would listen to that?
Right, but Mitt Romney did venture into the territory that we were talking about a second ago with Der Spiegel, their warning, and Bill Maher's making analogies with Hitler, etc. Mitt Romney said, this is the very brand of anger that has led other nations into the abyss. That's pretty unequivocal what he's talking about.
Right, no, I think that's a point well taken. The question is whether in substance he represents that danger. I mean, psychologically, I think it's true that when people are upset and angry and you're talking about, you know, a population of voters who feel betrayed and left behind, they are probably, in a situation like that, the most susceptible to a demagogue. You know, if there were prosperity and everything were well and people felt secure and they have high rates of employment, they might be looking at the president from a completely different perspective in the way that you might want to hire somebody to do surgery on you, meaning they're simply interested in qualifications, competence, ideas, etc. But that's not the case when you're talking about a situation where people are angry and frightened and feel betrayed.
So, Richard Friedman, given that it's unethical to diagnose from afar, and particularly in terms of politicians, and that goes back to the historical record with the Goldwater 1964 campaign, then is it possible or ethical or useful to diagnose the electorate then, to sort of try and figure out what kind of pathology lies within these voters that are rushing to Donald Trump's banner? And frankly, he is bringing people out that haven't voted before, a lot of independents, a lot of so-called Reagan Democrats. But it seems to be in the broader sense that there's this sort of nihilism about experience, expertise, science, temperament, linguistic style. I mean, that is a broad critique of America itself, isn't it? Where facts are a moving target. He who spins the truth the best wins.
Yes. I mean, that's all true, but I would say that's not particular to American culture. I would say that's fundamentally human. When you're dealing with people who feel in emergency states of emotion, who are angry and feel betrayed, et cetera, they are the most susceptible to appeals by emotion and least susceptible to reason. Whether you're talking about Americans, you're talking about Germany, let's say at the close of the Weimar Republic, you have a similar dynamic. You know, who it is who rises up and achieves prominence in settings of vulnerability like that differ from place to place. But I don't think that that fundamental characteristic of, an appeal to emotion is particular to American voters. That's universal.
And is it also universal, this, celebrity worship, adoration of the wealthy? I mean, in the Brits, for example, of course, have the royal family, and in many ways, in fact, I've seen more adoration of the British royal family here in the United States than anywhere else. So,
right.
And yet we had a revolution against the British, although I recall that I think it was Alexander Hamilton wanted to make George Washington king. So what is that impulse?
Well, I think the impulse is people enjoy the powerful fantasy that they, like their leaders, can identify with him and be powerful just like they are. And to some extent, that's why the Republican Party has been so successful over many, many years, and why now Trump threatens that strategy. Because, as it turns out, many of the people who were promised the American dream, let's say by Republican policies, really see that it's out of their grasp. None of the economic policies that were pushed by the Republican Party achieved any of that for the people for whom it was promised. It's not surprising that people are angry and they're upset.
Well, but the historical tradition, of course, is that when people get disgusted with democracy, and clearly there's a disgust at the gridlock and paralysis in Washington, that they turn to more illiberal forms of governance, notwithstanding the hyperbole over Trump being a fascist. There is, of course, clear elements of right-wing populism out there. So where's that line?
There's no question about that. And the reason they're vulnerable to it, I think, like all of us, is, when you've heard people telling you so long that they're going to do A and B and C and you're going to benefit from it, and then you see nothing happen, and you see the politicians, are locked in gridlock and can't get along with one another, and none of the things that you hear about actually become reality, it's rather refreshing to have a character like Trump come along and basically tell you exactly what it is you felt all along, that these people are dishonest, that they're not to be trusted, they've taken you for a sucker, and I'm going to just destroy the whole thing, and they're liars, and I'm an outsider, and they are incapable of giving you what it is you want. But it's remarkable, when people are in that position, they don't stop to say to a character like Trump, "That's great. We're really glad you understand how angry and upset we are. Now tell us exactly what you're going to do to fix it." That's not happening. At least it's not happening yet.
Well, the extraordinary thing, though, is that the trashing of government itself over these decades has been engineered and propagated by the Republic. And they certainly, in this last 8 years, have trashed the institution of the presidency and along with demonizing governance itself. And there's also obviously been a clear racist tinge to a lot of the hatred that's been directed at Barack Obama. On the other hand, and also the Republicans are largely responsible for the gridlock. So is this a case of being both the arsonist and the fire brigade?
Yes, it's a little of both. I mean, you can't have it both ways. You can't both attack the government from inside, meaning the Republicans themselves, who, after all, is the government. The government is, all these people who we elect who sit in the, Senate and sit in the House of Representatives. And yet, from inside, you hear within the ranks of the elected officials that government is bad. So if you vilify the government and you're part of the government, what does that tell you?
Well, but does it extend to the idea that you can rescue the government or reinvent it? Is that, I think this is obviously a bad year for status quo politicians. You can see it on the Democratic side that Hillary Clinton's struggling with the idea that she wants to improve government, where Bernie Sanders wants to change it.
Right. Well, this is the risk. I mean, rationally, you know, if you're voting for someone, you at least want to vote for somebody who you think is going to help you or do something that's useful to you or enact a policy that's going to be benefit to you. But I think psychologically, the paradoxical effect of hearing a Democrat say to you, you know, you have been betrayed and you're disadvantaged and we have policies that will help you, psychologically does not go over very well because it makes people feel weak. In contrast, if you have somebody like a Trump or a Republican who says, we're going to make this country great again, everybody can have everything they want, we're going to cut taxes and, you know,
get rid of the IRS.
and we get the economy going again. You know, it psychologically feels much more powerful to people, even if it's unrealistic and impossible, and even if the numbers don't add up. In other words, I think the emotion nullifies the data.
Well, Richard Friedman, I thank you for giving us a lot to think about here today.
A pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Richard Friedman, MD, who's a professor of clinical psychiatry at the Weill Cornell Medical College. He's also an attending psychiatrist at New York Presbyterian Hospital and director of psychopharmacology at the Payne Whitney Psychiatric Clinic. And he's also a contributing op-ed writer to the New York Times. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into how dog whistle politics have entered the mainstream.
I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head.
You've been born with white skin, they explain, and the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train. But it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in our game.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ian Haney-Lopez, who's a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity. Since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law, he remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America. A former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools, his latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Haney-Lopez.
Glad to join you again.
And the Trump phenomenon, of course, has got all kinds of people alarmed, abroad in particular. Der Spiegel, the German magazine, is calling Trump the most dangerous man in the world. And there's been a lot of hyperbole about him making comparisons to Trump and Hitler and Mussolini. So I think in the broadest sense, though, what seems to be happening in this election year is that the kind of work that you've done on dog whistle politics has been eclipsed in a way where it's no longer dog whistle, which is coded messages. It's now out in the open, isn't it?
Yes and no. So I think that historically the dog whistle, the speaking in code and using terms like illegal alien or welfare queen that on the surface don't reference race but that underneath have strong racial messages, I think that those codes have been designed to hide race from two different audiences. The one, the liberal critic, the other, the very population that these politicians seek to mobilize. And I think that what we're seeing with Trump is that he doesn't care whether his liberal critics or his European critics see that he's engaged in race baiting. In fact, I think he's recognized that it actually helps him. That to the extent that the Washington Post, the New York Times, European journals criticize him, that actually builds his credibility with the base as someone who's not subject to political correctness and really telling it like it is. But at the same time, I think Trump is very careful to allow his base, his supporters, to assure themselves that they are not themselves racist. And that's where I think you really see that he made a big mistake by not disavowing the Klan immediately. He can pretend to his base that he's talking about religion, that he's talking about behavior, Mexicans as criminals, that he's just talking about national origin. He says, well, maybe they're Mexicans, but maybe they're Central Americans, maybe they're Syrians, we don't know. But he cannot use a racial epithet, he cannot refer to skin color, and he cannot accept unequivocally the endorsement of the Klan. And so in that sense, I do think it's still operating as a dog whistle, though only insofar as that Trump is creating this veil that allows his supporters to say, hey, things are changing, these people are dangerous, this is common sense, and I'm not racist.
But clearly he's smart, he's clever, and much of the criticism about him, I think, is misplaced because he's obviously very strategic, very tactical, and he's doing incredibly well. So that's not the hallmark of an idiot, you know, hardly.
I completely agree. I think that he's an exceptional salesman. He really has his pulse on the finger of the Republican base, and indeed a lot of the electorate. Now, we should be clear that it's 50 years of racial rhetoric on the right that has sown the ground for this. So Trump didn't invent this phenomenon, but I think that Trump is a brilliant salesman. He recognizes the sort of rhetoric that appeals to folks. He recognizes the base stories by which they understand economic calamity in their lives as the fault of other poor people of color. He's drawing on this. I'd like to go back to this idea that Trump is the most dangerous man in the world. Frankly, I think that that's absurd. I think that somebody like Ted Cruz is far more dangerous and would be far more destructive to the country and to the international order were he elected. I think that describing Trump as the most dangerous man in the world is to see him as a sort of a demagogic, Hitler-esque figure. That's not what he is. Trump is still well within the mode of even establishment candidates like Mitt Romney, who spent over half of his advertising budget falsely trying to tie President Obama to welfare fraud. Trump is well within a tradition in the Republican Party of using coded race baiting. I think that Republicans are very nervous about him because, he's more explicit. It's more obvious the sort of race baiting he's doing. More fundamentally, I think that the Republican establishment is outraged because there's a good chance that Trump will win the primary but lose the general. And that more than anything, and tarnish the brand with his more evident race baiting. But a President Trump, we can imagine, would be continue to serve the interests of the very rich. He's promising massive tax cuts for the corporations and for the top income tax brackets. If he were a bit more isolationist, I don't think jeopardizes the world. He's not an idiot, and he's not as much of an ideologue. I don't think he'd be anywhere near as destructive to the social fabric or to the international order than an ideologue like Ted Cruz.
And again, I'm speaking with Ian Haney-Lopez, who's a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley. He's a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools, and he's the author of White by Law. And his latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. So just to finish up on why he didn't repudiate David Duke when he had an ample opportunity to do so. Clearly that was calculated, even though he pretended his earpiece was defective. What was his strategy there, given that he's smart? Was it because of Louisiana vote, or what was it?
I think he miscalculated there, and I think it's one of the few times he's miscalculated. I think that he was flirting with the Klan, that he knows that he's flirting with the Klan. He knows that he's flirting with the white supremacists. He knows that he's been endorsed by Stormfront. He understands that. And I think that he misunderstood that it's okay, you know, it's okay to have messages that resonate with those folks as long as you stick to the basic racial rhetoric of the right, which is to say racism is wrong, racism is immoral, but some people don't value human life, some people have dysfunctional cultures, some people are basically illegal, right? That's the rhetoric. Even Ronald Reagan, who would lecture about strapping young bucks, buying T-bone steak with food stamps, or welfare queens, Ronald Reagan was always very clear to say, bigots are sick people. And that's the frame. So it's a post-civil rights racial rhetoric in which the right wing says we are four square against racism. Racism is un-American. But we're going to define racism as people who wear bed sheets and burn crosses. And all of our rhetoric about needing to crack down on crime in the inner cities, that has nothing to do with race. So Trump has been solidly within that tradition. But I think that he miscalculated and he didn't realize he really does need to condemn the Klan. And he needs to condemn the Klan not just to appease the critics in the mainstream. I don't think he cares about that. He needs to condemn the Klan so that he can carry most of his own supporters who are both racially fearful and absolutely convinced that they are not racist.
Well, that, of course, is where the rubber meets the road, I think, in this year and in our discussion, is to try and figure out, Ian Haney-Lopez, about the fact that there's so much anxiety amongst the people that are coming out to vote for Donald Trump, largely poor, white, working and middle-class white, particularly white men. And, of course, the American tradition has been that they're superior to immigrants, non-whites, women, non-Christian, gays, etc. But now you have more immigrants. The country's becoming less white. More women have become educated and moved into the workplace. Gays have become more visible and acceptable. And now with gay marriage, of course, that's right in their face. So it seems to me that it's not even Trump, actually, who's the worst in this regard. It's Dr. Ben Carson, who keeps using the word politically correct. Isn't the use of political correct by conservatives now a kind of cover for permission to be bigoted?
I think that's exactly right. I think that politically correct is operating as its own dog whistle. I think it's aimed both at disfavored minorities and at cultural elites. So what's happening with the phrase politically correct is it's a way of saying, hey, all of you who suggest that we should think and talk about social relations in a way that doesn't replicate unjust hierarchies, you're actually out of touch, you're pinheads, you're eggheads, you're these, you know, lefty elitist thought police. And what it's doing is at once it's saying, we need to ratify the dominant hierarchies of the time, white over non-white, men over women, straight over gay, Christian over non-Christian. It's doing that, but it's also saying, who's the elite in this country? It turns out it's going to be, you know, people like me, the Berkeley professor, you know, the sort of New York intellectuals, who is not the elite. The Koch brothers, the corporations, the dynastic families that have arisen in the last few decades, right? And so it's a way of saying to working class folks, listen, there is an elite in this country that is your enemy. It's not the very rich. Instead, it's this cultural elite, and they're your enemy because they disdain you, right? And so that's the work that political correctness is doing. And I think it's absolutely essential that progressives respond by saying, politically correct is actually an effort to create a more socially just and inclusive society, and it's not cultural elites who wield the greatest power in our society. It's, in fact, people like the Koch brothers who are going to spend millions and millions of dollars to try and hijack the election this season.
$889 million, to be precise.
Exactly.
But Ian Haney-Lopez, I think in a way what you're saying here, well, you're not saying it, but it certainly springs to mind that Bernie Sanders is the antidote to Donald Trump. Bernie Sanders is the one who's pointing out who the real elites are. And Donald Trump is the sort of is distracting the very same people who are the victims of inequality. And it would seem to me that maybe that's the race we need, Bernie versus Trump, if Trump is to become the nominee. And actually, polls indicate that Bernie Sanders would do better against Trump than Hillary Clinton.
I'm sure he would. I'm sure he would. So a lot of people draw a parallel between Trump and Sanders, and in one way it's helpful, but another way it completely misses the point. Yes, both of them are tapping into a sort of a deep economic insecurity and a deep anger about what has happened to our country and the extent to which it's been hijacked. But Sanders is actually real. What he's saying is consistent with who he's been for 30 years. It's a perceptive analysis of how power operates. He's got an actual solution, which is broad-based mobilization of the public. Whereas Trump, it's all baloney. He's a complete fraud in what he's saying. It is inconsistent with his prior positions. There's no analysis whatsoever. There's just bombast and hot air. And he's got no vision for social change. He's not interested in social change. He's just interested in bamboozling voters and gaining the White House and stroking his own ego. So I think that to the extent that people are sort of trying to figure out which one to support, with a little bit of attention, I think they'll realize that there's substance to Sanders that is just completely missing with respect to Trump. Now, I think to think about the relationship between Sanders and Clinton, I think that Sanders has actually treated Clinton with kid gloves so far, that the right wing is salivating at the prospect of her being the nominee, that Trump will absolutely savage her. And that Clinton is not in a good position to press the case against Trump, because Trump can easily say to her, you represent the interests of Wall Street. You're in the pocket of Wall Street. I'm a billionaire. I'm independent. And Clinton has no good answer, nor, I think, does she have this larger vision of what's going to be required for political change, which is broad-based mobilization. I think that we can expect from Clinton mobilization only insofar as it's necessary for her election, but I don't think she's committed to a broad new social movement that demands fundamental change in the structure of our political parties, in the structure of our government, in the structure of our economy.
And Ian Haney-Lopez, back to Trump versus Cruz, now that Cruz has won two out of the four, Trump winning the other two in Saturday, or now it's called Super Saturday, and you made a point earlier that you find Cruz scarier than Trump, and I certainly concur with you. It doesn't seem like Mitt Romney's takedown or an attempted takedown of Trump has particularly worked with the Trump supporters. Because, you know, basically what I don't think anybody likes to be told that you're a sucker, do they?
Right. Well, it's not, I don't think it's quite that. I think that the problem with the Republicans trying to take down Trump is that Trump is using their playbook. So they're in this incredibly awkward position of having to say of Trump, everything you don't like about him reflects very poorly on us for decades. And everything you like about it reflects very poorly on us because this is how we've been manipulating you ourselves. So that Romney can't prosecute the case against Trump. Now, he can't prosecute the real case because it's too much a case against Romney himself. Right? And I think that there's another facet here. Trump is right in what he's saying to the Republican base, that the establishment never really cared about you, that the establishment really didn't care about working people in America, that they strung you along with all this rhetoric of hate and resentment, but all you ever got was tax cuts for the very rich, the rich getting richer, and your pensions and your jobs going away. And now how exactly is the Republican establishment going to respond to that? Now, I think it takes somebody like a Sanders who can turn around and say of Trump, A, you're right, the Republican establishment has hoodwinked most of its supporters, and B, you're doing the same, because you're not going to do anything for working people. You're on record as opposing unionization in your own hotels. You're on record as saying wages are too high already. You're on record saying we just need to come down so that we can bring jobs back. You yourself are going to betray the interests of the working people. But the Republican establishment can't say that, because it's too close to what they've been doing for decades.
Well, but I think in that regard, just in closing, Ian Haney-Lopez, that Cruz is more dishonest, or as Trump calls him, lying Ted. I mean, his wife is an executive at Goldman Sachs. He got elected thanks to a secret loan from Goldman Sachs and Citibank. And he is a classic McCarthyite. I mean, going back to Chuck Hagel's confirmation hearings, a fellow Republican senator who he accused of taking money from North Korea. So he does that McCarthy thing. He throws out completely specious and ungrounded charges and then, you know, lets the chips fall. I mean, it's the most dangerous form of political demagoguery that one can imagine. But I don't know. He seems to be getting away with it.
Oh, I think so. I think this is what makes him dangerous. I think that he's in a stronger position than Trump to pass himself off as a principled conservative, whereas I think that that he's a more dangerous combination of a lying egoist, just like Trump, but also a sort of right-wing ideologue who is willing to use all sorts of dirty tricks and dirty politics and lying and manipulation in the service of the most powerful interests in our country, the big corporate interests. I think that's who Ted Cruz is. I think that's what makes him dangerous. We should be clear. I think that's who Marco Rubio is, too. I think Rubio has nothing to sell, nothing to offer the country, except to the extent to which he's willing to sell himself to corporate interests. The easiest way to see this is to look at the tax plans of Trump, of Cruz, and of Rubio. Each of them are offering massive, massive tax cuts to the very wealthy, which would create trillions of dollars in debt. And they offer no plausible economic justification for why they would shower the big corporations, the wealthiest family dynasties, with these massive tax cuts, these trillions of dollars in wealth, other than the fact that these are the interests that they're serving.
Well, Ian Haney-Lopez, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Ian Haney-Lopez, who's a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity. Since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law, he remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America, a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. His latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining Ohio, the other key March 15 primary state. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now, Daniel Kakaji, who's a professor of law at The Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law and a senior fellow at Election Law at Moritz, whose area of expertise includes election law, civil rights, and federal courts. He's the co-author of the casebook, Election Law, Cases, and Materials. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Kakaji.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Daniel, your governor, John Kasich, seems to be betting it all on winning Ohio, and he's also put a lot of effort into Michigan on Tuesday, but he doesn't look that good in the polls. He's also predicting a contested Republican convention out of which he will emerge as the winner. So what's he smoking?
Well, I don't think it's so crazy to imagine that there could be a contested Republican convention, especially given the results of last night, where Trump didn't do nearly as well as one would have expected. And I'm talking especially about Kentucky and Louisiana, where most folks were expecting him to win handily. And that suggests that some of the attacks that have been leveled against him over the past several days may actually be working. Now, John Kasich and, for that matter, Marco Rubio are not going to wind up in Cleveland with a majority of delegates, but it is certainly possible that Trump won't.
So what is then the strategy for the governor? Because I understand, even though he's campaigning on the idea of inclusiveness, bringing people together, yeah, I understand that he's not particularly popular with his own caucus and with the Democrats in state government.
Well, I think as Republicans go, he's actually pretty highly regarded. Look, he started off his governorship going after public sector labor unions, and that was extremely unpopular. You may remember Scott Walker of Wisconsin did the same thing. The big difference is Kasich lost and Walker won, and as a result, Kasich had a bit of a course correction. And that included steering the state in a more moderate direction and taking the Obamacare Medicaid money, which was not an easy thing for a Republican in a state like Ohio with a solidly Republican legislature to do. So I guess I challenged that contention. And look, John Kasich, if you've actually watched this debate, has positioned himself as the grown-up in the room. Now, he hasn't won any states yet. He has got a good chance of winning Ohio, but that's what one would expect. But I think his hope, and for that matter, the hope of Rubio and Cruz as well, is that Donald Trump doesn't go into the convention in Cleveland with the majority of delegates. And that's not at all beyond the realm of plausibility. And the thinking is, if Trump doesn't have a majority of delegates, then who knows what's going to happen once the convention begins. So, it's looking at this point quite possible that we could see the first contested convention in several decades.
Well, indeed, at this point, Trump has 378 delegates and Ted Cruz has 300. And I take it that, we know that Ted Cruz, for example, is not backing out of Florida, because Mitt Romney suggested that they sort of abandoned campaigning in Florida to help Rubio win and abandoned campaigning in Ohio to help Kasich win. But Cruz is doubling down in Florida, and you've got this Our Strategies group, this funded by this hedge fund billionaire, Paul Singer, that's blanketing the airwaves to help Cruz. Is that same thing happening in Ohio?
Well, it hasn't been very visible if it has been. That's what I can say. And I don't think that Cruz has much of a chance of winning Ohio, or for that matter, taking that many votes away from anybody. Cruz has his cadre of loyal supporters here as in anywhere else. But it's not likely to be enough to win, and so it's likely to be either John Kasich or Donald Trump who wins the primary. And at this point, based on what's happened over the past few days, where the attacks on Donald Trump really actually finally seem to be having some effect, my money would be on John Kasich to win Ohio. Florida, the other big state of the day, as you mentioned, of the day that is next week, it's hard to say. Rubio has not been performing up to the expectations of many people, especially those in the so-called establishment. He seems to be being heard as well by the sort of childish display of insults and braggadocio that we've seen over the last few days. So it's it's really hard to say exactly what's going to happen in Florida at this point.
So let's turn to some of the quirks now in elections in Ohio. It's almost, some of it's looking a little bit like what we saw in Florida in 2000 with mm-hmm. the butterfly ballots. There's a lot of confusion now over this new ballot that you get two boxes to tick off. Explain that to us. And also the Secretary of State in Ohio has actually stopped 17-year-olds who will be 18 by the November elections from voting in the primary, which, you know, 28 other states and the District of Columbia in this country allow to happen. The Buckeye State did allow that, but now this Republican Secretary of State has reversed course.
Yeah, well, I'm going to focus on that one because I think that is a significant issue. The former Secretary of State was allowing people who would be 18 by the time of the next election to vote in the primaries. That was Jennifer Bruner. Secretary Husted is not doing that. There's a dispute over what exactly Ohio's statutory law means and requires on that point. And so we'll see what's happened. And, of course, this is just part of a pattern. You know, since 2004, our elections here in Ohio have been as contentious as anywhere. And on several occasions, we've seen groups go into court challenging the decisions of the Secretary of State. This has happened quite frequently in the tenure of our current Secretary of State, Republican John Husted, and you know, some of the voters challenging Husted's decisions have actually won. For example, back in 2012, folks may remember there was a decision regarding the counting of provisional ballots, the so-called right church, wrong pew provisional ballots, right, where people go to the right building, but they vote their ballot at the wrong precinct, presumably because they were sent to the wrong table once they got there. A federal court said that those ballots had to be counted. There was also a case back in 2012 brought by the Obama campaign having to do with the disparate treatment of military and non-military voters with respect to early voting in the last 3 days before the election. Again, a federal court said that the Secretary of State's practices violated the practices, I should say, that he approved violated the Constitution and had to be stopped for that election. So, you know, we've had a lot of election litigation in the past. I expect we're going to have more and more issues emerge, given that we remain one of the critical swing states. And that's especially true for Republicans, right? It's going to be very difficult for any Republican candidate to win in November if he does not take Ohio.
So is this measure then, stopping the 17-year-olds who'll turn 18 by November from voting in the primary, is that aimed at hurting Bernie Sanders?
I doubt it, honestly. I mean, I don't think our Republican Secretary of State would at all mind seeing Bernie Sanders as the nominee, as unlikely as that probably is at this point. And, you know, I'm not... It's a disputed question of what Ohio law means. It may be one that winds up being litigated in the next few weeks, and I have no prediction at this point as to how that litigation is going to come out if it is indeed filed.
But in terms of this other feature of two boxes on the GOP ballot for March 15th, one designating an at-large presidential delegate and the other one designating a district delegate, there's an expectation that that's going to sow all kinds of confusion.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised at all if it does. You know, it's we've seen these sorts of things before. I mean, I was back in California at the time of the recall election in 2003. It was just at the time that I was moving from California to Ohio. And you may recall we had that two-box situation there as well, right, where there was the one box saying, do you want to recall Gray Davis, and then another choice about who you would vote for. And these sorts of things are predictably confusing to a lot of voters, which isn't necessarily to say that they violate the law. But, you can expect when you've got that kind of ballot that a significant number of people will be confused.
Well, then just in the last couple of minutes, and Daniel Takagi, You pretty much agree with John Kasich's prediction that there'll be a contested Republican convention.
Oh, I didn't go that far. I said it's possible. Uh-huh. I mean, I think, you know, there's really only one candidate who has the chance at this point, a reasonable chance of getting a majority of delegates going into the Cleveland convention, and that is Donald Trump. But it's not at all certain. He's running a bit ahead of where he would have to run in order to get the requisite number of delegates. But a lot of things can happen. So at this point, it's very, you know, I think the smart strategy for those who want to stop Trump is exactly what Mitt Romney outlined in his speech the other day. Vote for whatever candidate is likely to be the strongest opponent in that state. And your guess is as good as mine. I think Trump could well go into the convention with a majority of delegates, but it's by no means certain that he will. And a lot depends on how the campaign unfolds over the next several weeks. So I think it's not at all clear.
Well, the magic number is what, 1,237? And he's now got 378. So he's got
a ways to go. Whereas if you look on the other side, Hillary is in an extremely strong position to capture a majority of delegates.
But I was speaking to a number of political strategists the other day, an independent, a Republican, and a Democrat, all very, very experienced and very knowledgeable. And they all seem to agree that if the Republican establishment, in quotes, goes after Trump too hard or too, clearly trying to deny what he's won, that there could be sort of blood in the streets in Cleveland. And there are even analogies made to the Democratic convention in 1968.
I think it may be a fair comparison. I'm not sure that we're literally going to see blood in the streets as we did then, but there's clearly a huge fight, a civil war going on in the Republican Party right now. And, you know, this is one of the most remarkable things about this Republican campaign. It's exposing the fissures within this coalition between, you know, on the one hand, the moneyed elite within the Republican Party, and on the other hand, the grassroots. And let's face it, there's a lot of racism and nativism and sexism that we've seen, not certainly not from everyone, but from some elements, especially Trump's supporters. It could be that we are seeing a breakdown of this coalition upon which the party is founded, which could in turn lead to another major realignment of the parties, the likes of which we haven't seen for 50 years, really, since the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act triggered the last realignment of the parties.
Well, Daniel Takagi, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Good to talk to you, Ian. Take care.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Daniel Takagi, who's a professor of law at The Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law and a senior fellow of election law at Moritz. His area of expertise includes election law, civil rights, and federal courts, and he's the co-author of the casebook, Election Law Cases and Materials. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.